Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. I'm your host, Matt Calder, and today I will be joined by Civitas President Francis DeLuca on the show. But before we move into that, I want to make sure you are subscribed to the podcast if you aren't already by going and searching What Matters in North Carolina wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, if you're not following along with us on social media, follow us on Facebook at What Matters NC and also on Twitter at What Matters NC as well. You can catch more episodes of this show as well as the other shows on the network by going to freedomactionnetwork.com. Again, that is freedomactionnetwork.com. Now we will move right into Francis DeLuca.
All right, we have Francis DeLuca joining us now, president of the Civitas Institute, here to give us an update on things going on.
And Matt, I'm the president of Civitas Institute, but I also wear a different hat. I am the president of Civitas Action. And if the listeners are interested, this website is civitasaction.org. Civitas Action is what's known as a 501c4, sometimes called social welfare organizations, but they are nonprofits that are allowed to do a few more things. What our Civitas Action does is we score legislators on their voting. We score them on a conservative effectiveness. In other words, when we're done, we give them a score from 0 to 100, depending on how they vote on votes. And at civitasaction.org, you can not only see the votes for this year in 2017, you can see votes for other years, and you can see the lifetime scores of legislators past and present, and especially the people serving now. We maintain all those scores. And we first started doing this, I'll give you a little background on the conservative effectiveness rankings by Civitas Action. And we've been doing the scoring since 2008. The website currently has all the scores to 2011 because when we transitioned to a new site to start doing the updated lifetime scores, we lost some of the old votes. We're putting those in as we can get them back. But it is the only rating system in North Carolina that allows the citizens of the state of North Carolina to determine how their representative are actually voting on a broad range of important bills. And these are, they vote all the time. Most of the bills really don't have an ideological influence to them. They're things to name streets. They're things to allow cities to do things which only the legislature can allow them to do. A number of little things like that, bills that honor people or honor sports teams. But there are a number of bills that have significant philosophical leanings. So we try and determine on those bills that where you can determine, is this a conservative? Is this a liberal? Is it a what we would call a good conservative position? We have a few basic principles for determining that. We score votes on bills where we're able to clearly determine a conservative liberal tilt. And let me give you a couple of examples of bills that would do this. And any bills that would increase regulation, taxes, or spending would be bills we would definitely grade in. Or if they would cut regulation, taxes, or spending, we would grade those. It just depends on which they do as to how we grade them. If they're conservative, that's a good vote. If they're not conservative and you vote for them, that's a bad vote. So one of the things we would grade, any bills to require to do a business that previously did not require one. In other words, if you're doing something, suddenly the state comes along and says, oh, well, you have to have a state license, a state-issued license to do what you're doing. And I'll give you two examples of bills that did that in the recent past. These all both came in just in the past couple of years. One was to do hair braiding. Hair braiding used to be done by women mostly from either Africa or the Caribbean that would braid other women's hairs. And someone came up with the bright idea that, well, we should license those people. We shouldn't just let them do that because who knows what terrible things would happen. So that is now where those women who would do that with little formal education now have to have a state-issued license, have to pay for it. That is what we call a barrier to entry into a profession. And it's what keeps mostly poor and less educated people from advancing in life. And so we consider that a bad thing. It's not very conservative to keep people from doing what they want to do in the business world if they're not hurting anybody. The other one, another bill that is an example of a licensure bill that we actually did grade in the last couple of years, landscaping contracting. So if you hire someone to do your yard, they now have to have a license issued by the state. So, you know, it's to protect the health and safety and the look of the state, I guess, is what it is. You know, you can't have unlicensed landscape contractors running around messing up people's yards. And while I don't want anybody's yards messed up, I think most people would probably get references or look at other people, see them doing your work or word of mouth. In other words, I'm not going to recommend to my neighbor that they hire someone who I had a bad experience with. But guess what? If they're licensed by the state now, you not only have your sign you hang out, you have your state sanction that you do a good job. That's how I think most people interpret licensing. So we one of the big areas where we're always having to fight is the increasing number of professions that you have to be licensed to practice. North Carolina in the nation has one of the highest number of professions that you have to have a state license. So we're not talking about things, you know, most people would look at doctors and things like that. North Carolina is well into the 50s, approaching 60 different things. If you want to do it, you have to have a state license. And again, in the nation, I believe, last time I checked, that was in the top 5 of the nation in terms of number of licenses. We also grade any budgets, and we tend to grade them. If they increase spending more than population or inflation, we would say that's bad. If they increase spending less than population inflation, that's good. If they decrease taxes, that's good. If they increase taxes, that's bad. And I want to explain a little more about taxes, because sometimes, and especially in the budget bills, there are good and bad things. All budget bills pretty much increase spending because the state is growing in population, inflation is happening, so you tend to spend more money every year regardless of how good you try and do. We believe you could actually cut the budget in North Carolina, but unfortunately most legislators don't tend to agree with that. They think you got to spend more. But in terms of tax cuts, you may have a bill that lowers the personal income tax level but may expand the sales tax to a few more products. We would still, if the overall level of taxation was less, in other words, if, let's say, they lowered total income tax collections by $100 million, but they increased the sales tax collection by $50 million, that would still be a net tax cut of $50 million. So we would call that a good vote.
So I have a question in that vein. If let's say there was a net difference, so no net difference tax change, and they went from taxing an income level tax to a consumption tax, could that be a good vote?
Good question, Matt. So that is a good question. So let's say tomorrow they eliminated the personal income tax and they expanded sales tax to cover enough different things that it covered the amount of revenue lost by the income tax. We would grade that a good vote because we as a organization believe philosophically that it is better to tax consumption than it is to tax production. And when we say production, we mean everybody listening to this probably has worked for a living, whether it was run their own business or they work for the government or they work for a private business, they earn money. They did something to earn that money. That is productive work. And so we feel that you should encourage people to do productive work. And by taxing them less, you were encouraging that more. Now, on the other hand, government has to get money. So we think that if you treat all classes of things the same in terms of sales tax, that is a good thing, because then pretty much makes it neutral. You've got to do something. Do you hire someone to cut your yard, or do you buy a lawnmower? If you buy a lawnmower, you pay sales tax. If you hire someone to cut your yard, you don't pay sales tax. So you're making a decision how you make money, how you spend your money, and we think you should treat all the different activities the same. But you have no choice on how you earn your money if you work with your hands for a living. And when I say hands, that could be you write a newspaper, you know, you write an article for a newspaper, you sell something at a store, you type on a computer, whatever it might be, that is working for a living. The people who, you know, clip coupons, as they used to say, who are passive investors, don't work for a living. That's a whole different set. But the North Carolina income tax taxes people for working for a living. So that's where we think we would like to see no income tax on both personal and corporate. And on that note, corporate income tax is actually paid by individuals, be they, you know, because the corporations always include the cost of that in the products you buy. So there, you know, you're paying that tax whether or not you think so. And if you happen to invest in your 401k or in an IRA or you own stock yourself, you are paying that corporate income tax because in the terms of lesser return. So that would be the tax question. I think that answers your question on the taxes, right?
Oh, definitely. And whenever you're talking about consumption tax versus an income tax, I always think about New York and their cigarette tax. And the reasoning behind the cigarette tax is to get people not to smoke, to make people not want to smoke because it's expensive.
Perfect example.
So what is the reasoning behind an income tax?
Yeah, there's always been this saying, if you want less of something, tax it. So why are we taxing income? We want more income. And that is, so a good point. And one of the things they have found, though, there is a limit to what you can tax something in terms of your return. There is a, you know, there's a curve. The more you tax, the more you get until you get to a level that causes less. And states like New York have seen that with the cigarette tax. They raised it so high, people now don't buy cigarettes in New York. They go to the neighboring states to buy cigarettes, or they order them through the mail or something to avoid paying the cigarette tax. And they've actually seen their revenue fall off of cigarette taxes. And across the country, there's, you know, as cigarette taxes have produced less revenue than they anticipated in a lot of places. So the other kind of broad category of bills we tend to grade are mandate bills. Bills that mandate something of private citizens or of businesses. And I'll give a couple examples of that, because this is one that's always kind of controversial. But the legislature almost every year introduces a new insurance mandate. They require the insurance companies to do something, be it cover a specific kind of treatment or to treat drugs a certain way. And what this is basically doing is telling a private organization, an insurance company, which is dealing with private citizens, this is how you're going to conduct your business. But what it effectively does is it raises the cost of that product for everybody who buys it. And one of the reasons we have the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is that insurance had gotten more and more expensive because we continued at the state and national level to require it to do more things. And really a mandate is just a tax without the government actually having to spend the money it does. It forces other people to tax the people. So I require an insurance company that tells them, guess what? You're going to pay for everybody's haircut. I'm bald. I don't need a haircut. But guess what? Because my insurance now pays for haircuts, I have to pay a higher premium to cover everyone else's haircuts. So, you know, that is kind of the essence of a mandate on an insurance payment. But the over the years, insurance mandates and higher cost of insurance and people not being happy with it was what led to kind of the critical mass where our U.S. representatives thought they could change the insurance system wholesale without taking into account the impact of it. The other kind of I'll give you another example of a mandate bill. In fact, two of them. One happened back in 2007. It's what's called Senate Bill 3 here in North Carolina. They mandated the use of renewable energy in North Carolina. We're the only state in the Southeast that mandates renewable energy. We mandated that the utility companies buy renewable energy. Well, the reason they mandated it is because the utility companies weren't doing it, and there's a reason. It costs more money to have renewables in the system. But they said, we don't care, do it. And the electric customers, you out there listening, you'll just have to pay higher rates for this renewable energy. And the people who were the beneficiaries of this were not the customers, not you and me. The beneficiaries were the companies that produced the renewable energy. They were guaranteed a market. And over the last few years, billions and billions of dollars in North Carolina have been transferred from taxpayers and from electric customers into the pockets of a handful of renewable energy companies in North Carolina. We have figured it's probably in excess of $4 billion directly. And that's not even, that's in excess of what should have been done. And think about that. If I could get someone to say, hey, Francis, you want to start a business? We'll make sure that you have like $4 or $5 billion worth of customers out there, and they don't, and there's no choice. They have to give you the money. That's what we would call a mandate, and that's why we think those things are bad.
So, in that same issue, wouldn't it then reduce the need to advance that technology? I mean, why do I need to build a better mousetrap if you're already telling me I've got a guaranteed market for my mousetrap?
And one of the problems with government interference with the system is exactly that. You kind of tend to freeze in place where you are as opposed to innovation technology. And in North Carolina, the renewable is solar. That's what it is. It's almost 100% solar. We have really no other wind power or anything like that, or innovative new kinds of energy, geothermal or anything. It's all solar. And so what we have done now is we are saddling the electric users in North Carolina with about the next 10 to 15 years. They're going to be paying higher solar rates because the fact is that the technology is advancing, but we're going to be stuck with all this solar that's being installed now that did not wait for the technology to advance, did not wait for storage technology to advance. We're going to have this stuff on the system. And as a result of that, we had a bill this year that we graded. House Bill 589 was one of the bills we graded. And that was a bill that not only extended the requirement to expand solar by another, almost doubling it in the next couple of years from what we have now. So that's more customers for the solar people. It included instituting a subsidy program where rebates for solar customers. So in other words, now not only are you paying higher rates, but if you don't use solar, you're subsidizing the people who do use solar because they're not only going to get their power help paid for, they're going to get direct rebates for installing it. So we graded House Bill 589 as a bad vote if you supported that. And both House and Senate people did support that, so we graded that. Again, I want to tell CivitasAction.org. People can go look at all these votes. They can see the bills regraded. And before I go any further, I want to talk about actual kind of scores and everything. And again, the scores this year were very, you know, the whole range of everything. But what I did is I looked at how people did in the House and the Senate by party. But the let me tell you, in the House, the range of scores was from 8.3% up to 100%.
8.3%.
Yeah, that means a legislator voted right 8.3% on the...
I would be grounded until I was 30.
Well, actually,
if I was a high schooler getting that kind of progress report.
Well, let me go ahead and give you some things, and then we can talk about that. So that was a Democrat. That was he was the lowest Democrat in the House, John Autry of Mecklenburg County. He was at 8.3%. His constituency might like that because they may not be very conservative. That might be a liberal constituency. They may think it's great that we said he was one of the worst legislators and he was one of the worst. Now, it's interesting because Darren Jackson, who is the House Minority Leader, he's a Democrat, the Republicans control the House. Darren Jackson, the House Minority Leader, was the second lowest in the whole legislature. Of 120 members, he was second lowest at 15.4%. So he voted really right on one more bill than Autry did. So, you know, very much probably Darren Jackson, the House Minority Leader, is at the bottom of his caucus in terms of conservative liberal. Now, since I'm in that, I'll tell you, on the highest Democrat in the House was William Brisson of Bladen County at 62.9. He was higher than a lot of Republicans. He was right in the smack in the middle of a whole lot of Republicans at 62.9. And the lowest House Republican was Nelson Dollar of Wake County at 53.8. So you've got this kind of range of Republicans from 53.8 and Nelson Dollar of Wake County up to The highest House member was 100%, one person, and that's Chris Millis of Pender County. And
that makes a lot of sense knowing some of the things he's been pushing.
Yeah, well, Chris is a consistently conservative member. We like Chris Millis. We think he's very conservative. He's usually right on the issues. We can tend to bet that if we don't know what an issue is and he votes for it, we can kind of look at it and figure out which way it is. That's not what we do, but I think you could almost set your conservative watch by Chris Millis. Now, so I kind of went through the House. Those were the people. The House doesn't have a majority leader. They have a speaker, and that would be Tim Moore. And interestingly enough, Tim Moore's score is 69.2. So that put him at the lower end of House Republicans. And remember, I told you that William Brisson was at 62.9, so he was a little higher than a Democrat.
So knowing how the House Speaker usually doesn't vote on a lot of issues, does that hurt his score?
We have to only go by what he votes. So the ones he decides not to vote in, they just he is punished. He loses for not voting. He makes choices. If he didn't vote in any, we wouldn't grade him. But since he votes in a number of bills, we have to grade him right and wrong.
So if he had done nothing, he'd be better off, which Tillis, when he was a speaker, did, I would say, less
closer.
Voting.
It was interesting. As he got closer to election time, he would vote more when he ran for U.S. Senate. But that's another issue. In the Senate, it's different because Phil Berger, the Senate President Pro Tem, votes on every vote. And in his case, he had an 88.9. So that put him in the upper half of Senate Republicans. He was not the highest. There were five Senate Republicans who had 100. And I could give you the names, but I'm probably not going to try.
They'll have to go to Civitas Action.
Yes, civitasaction.org. There were also five Dems who tied for the highest of the Democrats, and they were at 22.2.
So on the whole, there seems to be more division between the Senate and
definitely
in the House, between the aisles.
Yeah, let me give you one more. The lowest Democrat, or the Dan Blue, who is the Senate Minority Leader, Senator Blue, he tied at 11.1 with four others for the lowest score. So their Minority Leader on both the House and the Senate was very much at the liberal end of the spectrum. The Senate leader was at the conservative end of his spectrum. The Republican leader in the House, who is the Speaker, was at the more liberal end of the legislature. I did not look at the majority leader in the House. I should have looked at that. I did not. But if you go to civitasaction.org, you can look up the majority leader and see.
They can run all the numbers they want to.
They can look at all the scores. They can look at this year. They can see the votes. They can see all the votes, the bill descriptions of them. They can do anything they want, and they can actually look past it, do averages. This year, we found that the Senate average was higher than last session, but the House average dropped, which means that the Senate voted a little more conservatively, in our opinion, than last year, but the House a little less conservatively than that year. And that's really one of the valuable things here. We see big trends, not just one vote. And we try and look at, as I said, trends across a broad spectrum of bills, not a narrow thing. We just don't grade fiscal. We don't grade social, just social. We grade any bill that comes across that we can define an actual ideological spread.
You really get to kind of take a temperature of the House and Senate over time and see where they're really going.
And the individual legislators, because we track it over time, so we get to see how they go. And what we tend to see in some legislators who are not either real conservative or real liberal, as their time in the legislature goes on, they tend to move in a more liberal direction. I'll just make that as a kind of a blanket statement. Not true in every case, but in a lot of cases it is.
It's very interesting.
Well, again, if the listeners are interested, civitasaction.org. If they've got any questions, they can email us here at Civitas, and we're happy to answer them. And I hope you'll go check it out and find out what your legislator is doing.
All right. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Always good to be here.
All right. Well, thank you to Francis for taking the time to speak with us today, and thank you to you, the listeners, for taking the time to listen. Make sure you're subscribed to the podcast by searching What Matters in North Carolina wherever you listen to podcasts. Make sure you're following along with us on social media on Facebook and Twitter at What Matters NC. And go check out the Freedom Action Network website to find more episodes of this show and other shows on the network at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. Again, that is www.freedomactionnetwork.com. We'll catch you later.